Good evening. Welcome to this evening's meeting of the Aristotelian Society. It's a great pleasure to welcome Stacey Friend, who did her PhD in Stanford and then spent a year as a postdoc in Ann Arbor. Her first teaching post was at Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. Then she came to the UK in 2005 to take up a post at Birkbeck. She's now at Heathrow, where she's a senior lecturer. Her research interests focus on problems in fiction, in aesthetics, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of language. She's published widely on those topics, and this evening her paper is entitled Fiction as a Genre.
Thanks. And thank you for having me. I'm going to try to suppress my natural tendency to pace widely. Due to the recording. All right. So when philosophers talk about fiction, they typically have one of two questions in mind. They think of fiction, some think of fiction as a domain posing puzzles about reference and non-existence, which is typically the topic in philosophy of language or metaphysics. And here the contrast people have in mind is between fiction and reality. And a different conception of fiction as a kind of representation, where you're talking about novels or movies or what have you. And this tends to be the interest in aesthetics, among other places. And here the relevant contrast is between fiction and nonfiction. And this is the topic that I'm focused on today, the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. Okay, why should we care about this distinction? Well, the basic answer is that the distinction between fiction and nonfiction shapes our practices of understanding and evaluating particular works, okay, in ways that, at least I think, are very interesting. So, for example, James Frey's A Million Little Pieces, I don't know how many people are familiar with this example. A Million Little Pieces is the first-person nonfiction memoir of a drug addict. It was widely hailed. Frey was on Oprah, et cetera, which I believe is the highest praise that you can receive in American publishing. And it turned out that he had not been an addict. He'd done a lot of research and he knew a lot of addicts, but in fact he'd made up the first person experience. And he was roundly condemned and forced to retract, and it has been republished as fiction. Now, if it had been published as fiction in the first place, no one would have batted an eye, right? So the fact that it was nonfiction explains the controversy. Similarly, memoirs of a geisha, with more than one person has told me they thought was nonfiction when they started to read it, which I think just means they didn't actually look at the title page and notice the man's non-Japanese name as the author. But in any case, apart from a few benighted souls, memoirs of a geisha didn't receive much attention per se. It's a very good novel. Well-researched novel, but not a stunning revelation inside the secretive world of being a geisha, right? Had it been published as nonfiction, it would have received enormous attention and would have been stunning, okay? And another case, there's a genre of fiction called alternative history. An example of that would be the novel and movie Fatherland. For anyone who's familiar with it, it imagines that the Nazis actually won World War II, and there's a genre of nonfiction, which is called counterfactual history or virtual history. Okay. And alternative history is not in any way controversial, whereas counterfactual history, genre of nonfiction, does give rise to quite a lot of debate within historiography, and that's because it's nonfiction, not fiction. So the difference between fiction and nonfiction has implications for our ordinary practices and ways of evaluating these kinds of works, and that's exactly what I'm concerned with here. Okay, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to start out by looking at what are now the standard theories of fiction and explaining why I think that they're unsatisfactory. I'm going to defend an alternative account according to which fiction and nonfiction are genres, and this will have two theses, which I'll defend in order. The first is that membership in each of these categories is determined by a cluster of non-essential criteria rather than necessary and sufficient conditions. And the second is that classification as fiction or nonfiction influences our appreciation of particular works. I've already given a kind of rough reason for thinking that that's true, but I'm going to examine in more detail how this distinction influences our understanding and evaluation of works in each category. Okay, so standard theories of fiction. These theories define fiction in terms of an invitation to imagine or make believe the content of the work. Okay, and it's typically put in terms of a special speech act that authors undertake called fictive utterance, which is roughly involves a Gricean intention to invite readers to imagine the content of the utterances in the work in virtue of recognizing that the author has that very intention. So that's the standard, currently standard conception of fiction. Okay. And of course, the contrast, sometimes not articulated but assumed, is that nonfiction authors engage in the speech act of assertion and they invite belief. So that's the relevant contrast between fiction and nonfiction on this view. Now, generally speaking, as we'll see the reasons for this, the invitation to imagine is taken to be a necessary condition. There are additional sufficient conditions usually put forward. Okay. Now, the objection that I have raised in other places is that there's no concept of imagining or make-believe that carves out a response specific to fiction as opposed to nonfiction. Okay. And because I want to talk about my theory here, I'm going to be fairly brief in just going through why I think this is so. Okay. So the first reason is that the idea that works of fiction and only works of fiction invite imagining is just subject to counterexamples. In particular, there are works of nonfiction that invite imagining. Right? So anyone who's read or indeed watch the various documentaries on Ernest Shackleton's failed expedition to the Antarctic, right, who fails to imagine what is happening to the crew and, most strikingly, to their dogs. After, you have to read the book, okay? After their boat is crushed by ice, they simply fail to engage with the story, right? You can't but imagine these events occurring. Sometimes the invitation to imagine is explicit, right? So this is a passage kind of chosen more or less at random from Simon Schama's History of Britain. It says, take a look at Disraeli's Buckinghamshire country house, Hughenden Manor, with a stupendous over-direct decoration, da-da-da. Imagine its terraces full of peacocks, and the sense of Disraeli the sorcerer becomes more plausible. Okay. And Schama, if you sort of Google imagine and Schama, you will find millions of passages of this sort. Okay, so obviously, here are some cases in which works of nonfiction, authors of nonfiction, invite us to imagine, sometimes even inviting us to imagine explicitly. And I think that what's happening here is simply that narratives invite us to imagine events as they transpire, and many works of nonfiction are narrative. This may well be part of the motivation for the association between fiction and imagining, because most works of fiction, as I'll say later, are standardly narrative in structure. Okay, now, the reason that these cases might strike us as, yes, they invite imagining, but they don't invite imagining in the right sense, surely, right, to distinguish between fiction and nonfiction. And of course, the difference is that in these cases, what we're supposed to imagine is something that we are also supposed to believe. The imagining is compatible with believing the works in their entirety. We're supposed to imagine actual events as they occurred. Okay? So the obvious thing to do, and the thing that fictive utterance theorists do, is to put forward as an additional condition on fictionality some way of restricting the content that you're supposed to imagine so that it's fictive content in some people's terms, right? So the idea is to say the imagining must be directed at something that's made up, okay, in one sense or another. Various theorists have different views about this, right? So as I say, fictive utterance, then the invitation to imagine is only a necessary condition, so we have to add a sufficient condition. So in the paper, I talk about a couple of different examples. I'm just going to talk about one example for the talk, but I'm happy to talk about other cases. Okay, so Greg Curry's account is an obvious example. He says this, a work is fiction if and only if, A, it is the product of a fictive intent, that is, it involves fictive utterance, and B, if the work is true, then it is at most accidentally true. And Curry's goal when he wrote this wasn't to reply to my criticisms, but it was to rule out a case in which someone is putting forward as fiction content that is in fact true and known to be true. Okay, so that's the basic move that a fictive utterance theorist is going to make, right? And so I will object that that additional consideration is neither going to make it necessary or is not going to be necessary or sufficient for fictionality. So it's not necessary. There are lots of works of fiction that contain non-accidentally true statements, right? I mean, you can pick up many works of fiction, again, at random and find them. This is just an example from Elizabeth Gaskell's Mary Barton. This is the first sentence of the book. There are some fields near Manchester well known to the inhabitants as Green Haze Fields, through which runs a public footpath to a little village about 2 miles distant. Right? This statement is true. Gaskell intended people to believe it. It fulfills all the requirements on a sincere assertion. We can't claim that it's not an assertion because it occurs in a work of fiction, because that would be begging the question. It looks like a perfectly straightforward assertion occurs in a work of fiction. There are lots of other kinds of cases, right, where authors intend to be perfectly accurate with respect to, say, historical events, or the structure, overall narrative structure of events, so Gorvidal's, the 7 novels in the Narratives of Empire series. What makes the plots move are the actual events, even though there are fictional characters whose perspectives we get on those events, right? So it looks like there's quite a bit of non-accidentally true content, okay, that we're supposed to imagine in works of fiction. So it doesn't appear to be necessary, but also is insufficient. If we look at works of nonfiction, so one kind of case, leaving aside some more recent kinds of nonfiction, right? Roman historians and their early modern followers all the way up to the 16th century just made up battle descriptions, speeches, various other elements. There are kind of legendary heroes and all sorts of things that occur, say, even in Bacon's History of Henry VII. One of the things that often occurs in these kinds of works in Tacitus, but also in Bacon, all the way up there, is information about what the emperors are thinking, right? Internal monologue, just narrating their thoughts, telling us about the contents of people's dreams that Tacitus couldn't have any idea about. This is centuries removed from when he is alive. And it's not until the late 16th century that, at least in nonfiction history, there's a movement away from these kind of invented elements as just being standard and conventional as part of the writing of nonfiction history. And we could say, and some authors have said this in response, we could say that prior to the late 16th century, prior to the 17th century, right, these people were actually writing fiction despite what they think. But I think it seems much more, at least intuitive, to say that the conventions for writing nonfiction history have changed over time, okay? Making the fictive utterance theory problematic. Okay, so that's the basic objection to the standard original approach to fictive utterance theory, but there's a standard reply to this kind of worry, which is to say, and of course the term fictive utterance theory suggests this, right, to say that the criteria of fictionality that have been put forward actually apply to the parts of a work and not to the whole work. Okay, so the claim now is not that a work doesn't contain non-accidentally true content, but that parts of the work, right, meet these conditions and parts of the work may not. So Curry explicitly applies his conditions to utterances, and although he's not explicit about this, he seems to mean by utterance individual sentences in the text. So if the individual sentence is intended to be imagined and at most accidentally true, then they count as fictional statements. Okay. And Curry says that most actual works, however they are labeled by bookstores and libraries and so on, are mix of fictional and non-fictional statements, right? And there is no clear way to get from the status of the individual statements to the status of the overall work, to the classification of the work. So Curry is right that there's not going to be some mathematical formula to get you there, so it's good that he doesn't make an attempt to do that. But this is, I think, a problem. What we would like to know, what I would like to know for reasons that will become clear, is the status of the works. And what's getting left aside in this kind of analysis is precisely work-level classifications. So just to give an example, right, in 94, Edmund Morris, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian, published a book called Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan, in which he inserted himself as a fictionalized narrator who, along with various friends, also fictional, observed Reagan throughout his whole life. And sort of in middle age, the fictional Morris catches up to the real Morris, who was actually on hand as Reagan's official biography, to observe various events in Reagan's life. Dutch was, as this description should suggest, given it was the official biography of Reagan, very controversial at the time. But the controversy wasn't because people didn't know which parts were made up and which weren't. That wasn't the issue. The issue was, can you publish a work with those parts this way and that way as nonfiction, right? So we do want to know something about the overall work classification. So the problem that I see in all of these kinds of theories, these standard theories of fiction, is that they're reductionist, in a sense. They're trying to reduce fictionality to some property of the parts of the work or some single dimension of the work, whereas I think it's not about the parts of the work and how they add up to the whole, but in fact how the whole work is embedded in various practices of reading, writing, criticizing, publishing, and so on. And so the theory that I'm going to propose takes that seriously. What I will claim is that the kinds of features of works that fictive utterance theorists point to as defining fiction are actually what I call standard features of works in a genre. Okay, and I'll explain that in just a minute. All right, so now genres and classification. What do I mean by genre? Well, basically, for anyone familiar with it, but I will explain it, I'm thinking of a genre as what Kendall Walton calls a category of art, although applied to representations more generally. They don't have to be artwork. So I'm not going to make any claims that the works I'm considering all count as art. Okay. So the basic features of categories of art as Walton conceives them are those that I mentioned before. Classification is by a cluster of non-essential conditions, which will include certain historical facts about the work, about the intentions of the author, and contemporary practices. And even more importantly, these categorizations influence how we experience, understand, and evaluate the work by specifying a contrast class against which the work's features stand out as, this is what I'll explain, standard, contra-standard, or variable. Okay, those are Walton's terms. So what does that mean? Okay, standard features are ones that tend to place the work in a category, right? So flatness is standard for paintings, and an obvious but innocent suspect is standard for the whodunit. Okay. Contrastandard features are ones that tend to exclude a work from a category, right? So heavy drum beats are contrastandard for minuets, right? Quite surprising. All right. Variable features are those that can differ between works in a category without bearing on the classification. So the particular color and composition of a painting is variable. Okay. Now, we tend to be very sensitive to these distinctions without necessarily typically being aware of it. All right. So we take the standard features in particular for granted. In a couple of Walton's examples, right? We don't tend to see a Roman bust as a unicolored man severed at the chest, because being white and ending here is a standard feature that places those in the drama and in the genre of busts. We don't tend to see cubist paintings as paintings of squarish people. And we don't tend to see stick figure drawings as pictures of very, very skinny people, right, et cetera. Okay, we just take for granted, in these cases anyway, we take for granted the standard features of the work. So we're sensitive to these kinds of distinctions. Now, the standard features of fiction and nonfiction, right, are those we expect works in these categories to have based on various things, based on our past experiences with works of that kind. So in the past, I've read a lot of books that started with Once Upon a Time, and now I've come across another one, starts with Once Upon a Time, and I thought of those as fairy tales, so I think this is probably a fairy tale, so it's pretty straightforward. And also labels in the bookshop and classifications in the library and so on. So these kinds of things lead us to expect a work to have certain kinds of features. Those are the standard features. What are the standard features, broadly speaking, of fiction and nonfiction? Well, we expect fictions to engage us imaginatively through narrative, to deploy certain kinds of literary devices. I'll have some examples of that. To include invented elements, right? To make claims that are not assertions by the author, and so on, right? So those are some of the standard features of fiction. Some standard features of nonfiction: an effort to be faithful to the facts, references to real people, places and events, assertions that convey the author's views, and so on. Okay. Now, the point about standard features is precisely that they are standard as opposed to necessary and sufficient, right? So someone who is in the fiction section of the bookshop, doesn't know anything about it, picks up Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire, will expect a narrative and will instead find a 999-line poem annotated at novel length by an increasingly strange and unreliable fictional critic, right? So that's surprising, but it doesn't mean that the work isn't fiction. It's in fact the fact that it has a feature that's actually contra-standard for fiction and standard for a particular genre of nonfiction that's part of what makes Pale Fire an interesting book. Okay. So my claim generally is that fictive utterance theories pick out standard features of fiction. Okay. It's very straightforward. Not necessary and sufficient conditions. Right? So it's currently standard for fiction, right, and contra-standard for nonfiction to contain at least many statements that are not intended to be believed. Okay. And it's currently, you can say, standard for nonfiction, contra-standard for fiction to contain a lot of facts and so on. Okay, I haven't mentioned that here. So this is why we don't tend, or usually, there are exceptions to this, criticize fiction authors for making things up. Right? We're more tend to be surprised when something is called nonfiction. There's a lot of it that's made up, so on. That's what explains it, okay? Our expectations concerning standard features. But these are, as noted, defeasible expectations, right? I've already given some examples of works that surprise us in just these ways by defeating our expectations, by having contra-standard features. Now, one of the reasons for this is implied by the discussion of Tacitus and early modern historians, right? Genres evolve, they change, and the same is going to be true of fiction and nonfiction. So the standard features that we associate with fiction and nonfiction change over time. It's widely recognized for genres in general that conventions can change over time, right? One perhaps most obvious way in which this can happen is when you have a work that's influential, that breaks some of the rules of the genre, but that gets, as it were, taken up as changing the way that the genre can go forward. So an example of this is Agatha Christie's Murder of Roger Ackroyd, in which, you know, close your ears if you don't want to know who did it, in which the narrator turns out to be the murderer. Okay, and if this doesn't sound shocking to you, okay, you obviously are not a reader of mysteries in the 1920s and 30s. Christie received death threats as a result of this novel. Okay, that's how shocked people were. It led to a huge, huge protest and outcry. Okay, because it was just felt that the narrator, particularly the narrator who was established as the detective sidekick, it couldn't be the murderer because it was standard. You were supposed to be able to figure it out. And this was something, was like a trick. no one would ever have guessed it, so they couldn't figure it out, and they felt that they were betrayed. Okay. Now, of course, what happens with the murder of Roger Ackroyd, once the initial excitement dies down, is that it becomes and remains Christie's masterpiece. Right? It changed the rules of the genres. Christie herself had the narrator turn out to be the murderer a couple of further times, but in very different ways. So she changed the rules for the whodunit detective story. Right? There are other factors, variety of ways in which genres can change, and that's just one of them. And similarly for fiction and nonfiction, right? When Truman Capote wrote In Cold Blood, it was originally published as a series in 1963-64 in The New Yorker, and then put together as a book published in 1965. And this was essentially the first time that someone had used literary novelistic techniques to do nonfiction journalism, Okay? And it was groundbreaking, right? It was one of the most popular series that The New Yorker ran, actually. It's very widely read. And it was surprising and shocking. And people complain about Capote because he did falsify some things, right? But the fact that he falsified it doesn't make it fiction, right? Any more than falsified or plagiarized newspaper articles turn those things into fairy tales, right? So, all right. So this was a surprising, shocking development when Truman Capote did it. This is in 1964, 65. It is no longer shocking or surprising. Journalism students now have to take classes in creative nonfiction and new journalism and learn how to do exactly what Capote did. It's just now an option for the nonfiction journalist. Okay. So that changed. What was standard, what he did was contra standard, it is now variable for nonfiction. Okay. So given that we have these kinds of changes, it should be fairly obvious that the possession of standard or contra standard features, right, internal to the work all by itself doesn't by itself determine the categorization of a work, right? The kinds of features that I've been talking about that we have to consider are the historical factors concerned about the work, various historical features of the work. Now, in particular, I want to claim with Walton that we need to pay attention to knowledge of the author's classificatory intentions, that is, the category in which the author wants the work to be read, right, as well as categories that are established in the author's community, so the contemporary practices of classifying and reading various works. And you can see this when you consider something like Capote's In Cold Blood, right? There's a combination of Capote explicitly wanting this to count as nonfiction journalism, his purpose being his whole purpose was to find a story that he could show, that he could investigate and show could be made dramatic in the novelistic way, but be nonfiction, right? That was the whole point of In Cold Blood. Of course, it's not sufficient that Capote intended that. It may well have been that people there was no uptake, right? But instead, that's not the case. What happens is The New Yorker agrees to publish it as in their nonfiction features. Right. So what makes In Cold Blood nonfiction? Well, it's not just that Capote is talking about what actually happened, most of the time anyway, right? And it's not, certainly not because he used novelistic techniques, right? Okay, it's because he intended it to be nonfiction, The New Yorker took it up as nonfiction, readers accepted it as nonfiction, and so on, right? Similarly, I mean, if you consider Tacitus's Annals and Histories, they contain quite a lot of stuff that's simply made up. Okay? Why does that count as nonfiction? Well, because Tacitus was writing in a well-established genre of nonfiction history. His readers were completely aware of the conventions for nonfiction history at the time. There was no controversy about what Tacitus was doing, okay? Because of the current conventions and his intentions. Something like Gore Vidal's Lincoln, part of the series that I mentioned before, I mean, why is that fiction? because, I mean, kind of pound for pound probably contains less made-up stuff, as it were, than Tacitus's Annals and History. So why is that fiction? Well, it has to do with Vidal's intentions and contemporary conventions in 1984 when Lincoln was published, right? And finally, Dutch, I think, is a case where it's not really clear. At the time, there's no doubt that the author intended it to be nonfiction. It was published as nonfiction. Edmund Morris had all the credentials of a nonfiction presidential historian, up to Pulitzer Prize, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea of inserting the author as a fictionalized narrator and having fictional friends who get their own footnotes and stuff, right, that was just going a bit too far, really, as far as critics were concerned. And arguably, this is a case that's just very hard to classify. You can tell that these contextual historical considerations matter because all you have to do is change the context, right? And it seems fairly obvious. If Tacitus had written something like the Annals and Histories in the 20th century, it probably would have counted as fiction, right? He probably wouldn't have done that, but had he done it. If Vidal had written in the 16th century what he wrote, he would have very likely tried to publish something as nonfiction. Obviously, given that he's writing about Lincoln, he couldn't have written it in the 16th century, right? I do recognize that. Had he written something like that at the time, it very likely would have counted as nonfiction. And had Morris put forward Dutch as fiction, people wouldn't have raised an eye. Of course, nobody would have read it because it's an incredibly tedious work of fiction. All right. I mean, it's a pretty tedious work of nonfiction, don't get me wrong. But it's better. All right. So I conclude this first part of the paper saying that we don't classify fiction and nonfiction by necessary and sufficient conditions, including the conditions that fictive utterance theorists like Curry put forward, but rather we categorize them based on their standard features relative to when you're talking about the work having been published, the author's classificatory intentions, and contemporary categorization practices. Okay. So that's the first part of the argument. Okay. But that's not enough to defend the claim, right? It's enough to show that there is a serious problem with standard views of fiction and to put forward an account of when we actually do classify things as fiction and nonfiction. But it's not enough to show that fiction and nonfiction are genres, because genres, as I have defined them, have an effect on appreciation. So I have to show that the categories actually play a role in appreciation, right? So it could be that these categories are of no interest. So yes, this is how we classify fiction and nonfiction, but it doesn't matter, right? It is a possibility, so I have to show that it does matter. Okay. Why might we be skeptical that it matters? Well, you might be skeptical because it might seem that the categories of fiction and nonfiction are really just too broad to do any genuine explanatory work, right? So for all that I've shown, right, what really matters are the subgenres, right? We consider these the subgenres of the work, right? What matters is that Vidal was publishing historical novels and Tacitus was publishing classical history, right, or what have you. And that's what actually makes the difference to the considerations that I've discussed and how we appreciate the works. But the fact that the standard features of fiction and nonfiction can change so dramatically over time suggests that maybe these categories don't make a difference. Okay. So I just kind of use this, the skeptic can use an argument suggested by Don Lopez in Philosophy of Computer Art, right? So Lopez argues that digital music is not an appreciative kind. Okay. It's a kind, right? Music produced digitally is a kind. There's no question that there is music produced digitally, and it has fairly clear, relatively clear conditions for classifying things as that kind. But it doesn't really matter. This is digital artworks. I have been looking at the wrong parentheses. Sorry, I can see Dom's looking quizzically at me. Right, digital artworks, is not an appreciative kind. Let me start again. Because we don't compare anything that counts as a digital artwork, right, arbitrarily with other members of the kind, digital artwork. So we don't compare digital music with, say, digital photographs, right, as a matter of of course. Similarly, we can classify paintings by the weights of their frames, and we can establish a category of heavy paintings, okay? But the category of heavy paintings is not an appreciative kind because it plays no role in how we actually understand and evaluate paintings, okay? So that's fair. And so the skeptic claims that the same is true for fiction and nonfiction, right? So we don't standardly compare, say, the latest, I don't know, romantic comedy with epic poetry, what have you, on the fiction side, even though they're both kinds of fiction. We don't compare economics textbooks with Tacitus classical history, even though they're both kinds of nonfiction. So even though I've identified kinds, right, maybe they don't have a genuine role in appreciation. Right, so the reply that I want to make to that concern is, first, the fact that a narrower appreciative kind exists doesn't make a broader category irrelevant automatically, right? So digital music is still part of the category of music, and the general category of music makes quite a difference to our appreciation of certain kinds of music, at least, right? So recognizing that atonal music is a kind of music, which for some people isn't obvious, right, certainly has an impact on how we understand and appreciate it. And to the extent that we do understand and appreciate, say, John Cage's 4 minutes 33, it's the fact that it's put forward as music that's relevant to how we understand it. Okay, so the fact that there's a large category, by the category is large, and that smaller categories or subcategories are relevant to appreciation doesn't automatically mean that the larger category is irrelevant. And I claim that the categories of fiction and nonfiction are relevant. And we can't just test this claim by sort of ordinary armchair reflection, right? You can't just think about whether or not it matters to you in the ordinary course of events for two reasons. Okay, one, normally, when you're reading something that's fiction or nonfiction, you know a lot more about it than it's fiction or nonfiction. You may know who the author is, you may know its subgenre, et cetera, et cetera. You may know that your friend recommended it because it's a rollicking good time, whatever. All right. So it might not be possible in the ordinary course of events to distinguish what effects the fiction-nonfiction classification has from the effects that these subcategorizations might have. So that's one problem with simply reflecting on ordinary engagement. And a second problem is that there might be effects of the fiction-nonfiction distinction, or indeed any categorization, of which we are not aware. Okay, in particular, effects that get pulled out, and I'll talk about this briefly, from psychological studies that aren't just explicit in our ordinary trafficking with works of the various kinds. Okay, so I want to take each of these aspects of the reply in turn. First trying to isolate the effects, noticeable upon reflection effects of fiction and nonfiction, and then considering some of the effects that might not be as obvious to us. Okay. So isolating the noticeable effects, I borrow a strategy from Walton in Categories of Art. Okay. So what Walton is concerned about is what he calls, and I'm not going to get into all the details of this, perception in a category. So he thinks that the category in which a work is perceived, and he's talking specifically about perceptual artworks like paintings or music, the category in which it's perceived has an effect, a psychological effect, on how we perceive it. And in particular, it has an effect on what we take its aesthetic properties to be. Its properties of, for example, being graceful or dynamic, awkward, etc. Okay. So the example that he gives is a case called Guernica and Guernicas, okay, in lowercase Guernicas. All right, so imagine a society, for those who haven't seen Categories of Art, imagine a society in which they don't have the genre of paintings. So no such category exists. There are, in fact, societies like that. So no such category exists, but they do have an art form called Guernicas, as they say with lowercase g. Guernicas are bas-reliefs, okay, which have roughly the same kinds of shapes, color palettes, and subject matter of Picasso's Guernica. So you can imagine, perhaps in the town of Guernica, people being perhaps not having paintings. So pretend it's not in Spain, where painting has existed for a very, very long time. Okay, so in this town, so traumatized by the massacre were they that they developed this art form of working through the issues of what happens when you're massacred by doing bas-reliefs. I don't know why that would be a good idea. Now, these bas-reliefs differ, so they share as standard properties, right? They share roughly the subject matter and color palette and shapes and forms of Picasso's Guernica, and they differ in the way that they protrude from the wall. Okay, some are deeper, some are shallower, some are smoother and more curvy, some are more jagged and angular and so on. So that's the difference. Now imagine that this society comes upon Picasso's Guernica. Being unfamiliar with paintings, they will classify it as one of their kinds of works. And its most noticeable feature, right, the feature that will indeed be contra standard, is that it will be flat. This would be the most notable feature of it for them. And Walton suggests that if people in the Guernica society were to look at Picasso's painting, right, noticing primarily that it's flat, right, what seems to us to be presumably dynamic, violent, so on, might seem to them to be serene or static or even boring, right? But certainly not dynamic and violent. And Walton suggests that this is because they are viewing it in the category of Guernicas rather than in the category of paintings. He'll go on to argue that it is, in fact, given Picasso's intentions and so on, a painting and not a Guernica, and therefore it is genuinely dynamic and so on. Okay. But the point at issue here is that, according to Walton, you get a kind of gestalt effect. Right? If you were to switch between trying to see the work as a Guernica and trying to see the work as a painting, it should look to you to be very different as a result of the relevant contrast class, which just makes certain features, depending on whether they count as standard or contra-standard variable, stand out in your experience. Right? So that's the basic kind of a claim. So what I want to do is say that we can run a similar kind of experiment with the classifications of fiction and nonfiction. Okay, so shall have everyone, I will read this passage, but we will read this passage, and I'd like you to try to think about reading this passage as either fiction or nonfiction. Okay. So it goes like this: he was a dirty and unkempt man in his early 20s, his dark uniform torn to rags by his frantic, desperate run through the brambles. He was exhausted and frightened. He was like an animal, a far cry from the young lad who had arrived cocksure and full of Dublin mischief on the west side of Manhattan 3 years earlier. He had seen so much fighting, so much dying, and yet now the cause for which he had fought was no longer truly his cause, not since emancipation, certainly. His side was winning anyway. They wouldn't need him anymore. They wouldn't miss him if he ran away. Okay. This is a passage that's about a deserter from the Irish Brigade of the Union Army in the American Civil War. And I take it that if you read it as fiction, you will probably not even pay much attention to the fact that you're getting an inside view of the psychology of the person, right, of his character. You have certain features that go quite, just seem completely normal in a case of fiction. Like free and direct discourse, things like now the cause for which he had fought was no longer truly his cause, this mix of first-person perspective with third-person narration, it's free and direct discourse, right? You'll recognize references to real places and events, but that kind of thing is completely variable in fiction. Lots of fictions make reference to real things. But you won't know whether the character in question, call him the deserter, he's a deserter, existed, right? You just won't know from this as a work of fiction. Okay. Now, if you take this to be a passage of nonfiction, then you will assume, right, although you could be being radically misled, but you will assume that the individual in question did exist, that this is a real individual, that the claims that are being put forward are claims for which the author has evidence, right, whether he's put it forward here or not, you should be a bit surprised about the free indirect discourse, and you may well wonder how the author knows what this person was thinking. Right? So I take it that the distinction here, reading this as fiction or nonfiction and keeping everything else basically constant, does have an effect, right, on what we notice, what we take as standard or contra-standard or variable, and therefore what we're likely to wonder about, criticize, pay attention to, and so on. Right? So that's just a straightforward, intuitive kind of difference that you can see simply by running a Guernica-type case with fiction and nonfiction. There are also less obvious differences, things which maybe, if you see the psychological studies, will seem not so surprising upon reflection, but things that people don't normally consider. So, for example, people are inclined to think that we're less likely to believe what we read in fiction than what we read in nonfiction, if you ask them. But for certain kinds of facts, that's just not true. We're actually at least as likely, if not more likely, to believe what we read in a work of fiction than in a work of nonfiction, particularly when we're talking about kind of general, real-world sorts of background facts that are put forward in a work of fiction. So, relevant to this passage, we might be more likely to believe what we're reading about the general background facts about the Civil War or what have you, if we think it's fiction than if we think it's nonfiction. Okay. Another effect, which I don't think is quite as surprising, but which people don't just standardly reflect upon, is that we're more likely to pay attention to surface features and details if we think something is fiction. So when people are asked to retell a narrative they've just read, and they think it's fiction, they actually produce many, many more details from the stories, as well as using a lot more of the language from the original story than when they think it's nonfiction, and they control for various possibilities, and it is, in fact, does seem to be a result from the way they encode it in the first place. They remember those things from the beginning, depending on how they categorize the work. And this has implications for how we evaluate works in either category. So, for example, if the passage that I was describing comes from a work that's fiction, we may not mind if the main character didn't exist, right, that is in the passage, but we will mind if it turns out that there was no Irish Brigade in the Union Army in the Civil War, because those kind of general background facts are actually facts that we normally take to be accurate. And there are various other implications for how we evaluate works. Okay, so just because I'm sure you're all in horrible suspense, that particular passage is from a book called The Surgeon of Crawthorne, which is uncontroversially nonfiction. I mean, there's not even a peep controversy. I have to mention this because when I argue with people who have a different view, they tend to think every case is controversial, right? But this is not controversial. It's just written novelistically. That's it, okay? So at the time you can find various criticism online still. The time it was published, it was praised for its style. It was noted that it was unusual style. It was also praised for its detailed research and at the same time criticized for not providing evidence for certain kind of details of the sort that I've already pointed out. And these kinds of evaluations clearly turn on the classification of The Surgeon of Crawthorne as nonfiction. That's what all the critics were assuming, and that's how they read it. Okay. So I conclude from this brief foray that classification as fiction or nonfiction can make a genuine difference to how we appreciate works that are categorized either way, right? Why? Well, it directs our attention to different aspects of the work, plausibly because we treat different things as standard, contra-standard, or variable when we classify the works in one way or the other. But just because I think there's more to say about this, right? We don't really have a systematic account of such shifts in our on our attention with reading. There really isn't a lot of work on this particular issue. There's a lot more work on perception right? Specifically on how you classify things like paintings. There's studies of how classification affects eye movements, what you look at in a painting for a second, et cetera, and how long you look at certain kinds of things. There's actually quite a bit of research on that, but there isn't as much research on reading in a category. Okay, what are the mechanisms by which categorization of a work affects the way that we actually read a work? And so I'm not going to develop this here because I haven't developed at all. I'm not holding back. This is the next part of the project, right? Is that we should think of reading in a category, including reading as fiction or nonfiction, as adopting what psychologists call reading strategy or encoding strategy. And basically, that's just a strategy that you normally adopt subconsciously, you don't do it normally explicitly, for focusing on certain aspects of a text to compensate for the fact that we have limited working memory capacity. So you can't focus on every word and remember every sentence of what you're reading. You can't focus on every detail. In something large enough, you can't really focus on every character, on every scene, et cetera, et cetera. So we tend to focus on the things that we think are going to be most important for understanding what comes next and which give us ways of tying what we're reading to what we already know. So lots of studies show that people tend to focus on what matters to the protagonist, right, in a standard kind of story, or events that seem to be causally implicated in the main plot of the story. So those are examples of reading strategies. And what reading strategy we adopt can determine what we remember and how we remember it, so how we represent it mentally. And this has results for how we respond in comprehension tests and so on later on when we're asked what we remember about a text. So I think, or at least that's my suggestion, that when we read something as fiction or nonfiction, or indeed classify in various other ways, we're adopting a kind of reading strategy that tells us what sorts of things to focus on. So to summarize, there's a further conclusion that I can discuss if Marie says I should, but I'm happy to wrap up now. Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. Okay, so just a final remark. I think that once we recognize that fiction and nonfiction are genres, this opens up the possibility that we can discover other roles that this distinction plays in how we read and how we appreciate works in either category. And I think that this is a more fruitful line of inquiry than simply defining fiction and nonfiction as inviting specific responses a priori. And I'll stop there. Thank you.